Hi everyone, this is Scott. For a few years now, I've planned a series called The Ancient World Spotlight, where I'd post occasional interviews and one-shot episodes on topics related to the show. Well, what you have here is the first of those episodes, one dealing with Alexander the Great and his experiences in Central Asia. Before we get started, I wanted to mention a few things. The first is that I will, of course, be continuing my ongoing The Ancient World Theia series on the Seleucids. Just consider these spotlight episodes kind of bonus episodes that'll pop up from time to time. I also wanted to mention that I'll be away on vacation for the next few weeks, and apart from posting the second part of this interview sometime in October, it'll likely be later in the year before I continue the Theia storyline. Lastly, I wanted to mention that there are a few minor audio issues with this episode, so sorry about that, and hopefully it won't be too distracting. That said, let's dive on in. My guest today is Tristan Hughes, an historian and writer with a definite passion for ancient military history. Having graduated from Edinburgh University in summer 2018, he currently works at History Hit TV as web editor. He is also currently writing his first book with Pen and Sword Publishing, titled Alexander's Successors at War, The Perdiccas Years. Good to finally meet you. I'm glad we could make this work.
Yeah, thank you very much, Scott. Good to meet you via Skype, too.
I think I first came across you probably via Twitter, but pretty quickly came across your Battles of the Ancients website. Which I found to be just a tremendous resource for military historians. So thanks for all the great work on that.
Oh, thank you for the kind words. Thank you. Really appreciate it.
Yeah. So, but I know the thing we both really share an interest in and the thing we wanted to talk about today was our common fascination with Hellenistic Bactria.
100%. 100%.
So I wanted to start off, I guess, frame things a little bit with a quote from historian Frank Holt, his wonderful book, Lost World of the Golden King. So I'm quoting here, "Along the banks of the Amu Darya and the foothills of the Hindu Kush, Bactria once thrived as an independent kingdom ruled by the descendants of Western colonists. These wayward Greeks, remnants of Alexander the Great's army, waged incessant wars with their neighbors and with each other, growing richer all the while. They minted the largest gold and silver coins in the world, governed, it was said, 1,000 cities, conquered deep into India, which Alexander had failed to do, and then vanished. Their history morphed into legend, until even that was lost except for the names of a few phantom kings lingering in the quiet corners of classical and Renaissance literature." So I think that quote is pretty effective at capturing, you know, some, my fascination and what drew me to the Greco-Bactrians. If you can recall, how did you first become interested?
Well, quite a similar kind of thing, right? I think your quote really emphasized it. It's the fact that it's this Greek kingdom, like on a far edge of the known world. It's exotic, as it were, and it's shrouded in myth. But at the same time, you have these, you know, snippets of actual like factual information with which you can combine with like archaeological evidence to create this an interesting narrative of like the kingdom. And like so, one of the most fascinating facts, and your quote kind of mentioned it just then, was like the largest coinage in antiquity, you know, was actually made in the Greco-Bactrian kingdom, that remarkable gold coin of Eucratides. You know, I can't remember the exact measurements, but just things like that is just so remarkable.
So maybe let's get a little bit into the history. So the oldest culture that we know of in the region, you know, we're going back to the Bronze Age. So there's a culture called the Oxus culture, or the Bactria Margiana archaeological complex, which is centered on the Oxus River. It goes back as far, I think latest estimates are about 2400 BC, quite a ways back in time. And there's some interesting finds related to that culture, which, you know, were pretty exquisite. I remember seeing an axe head one time in the Met in New York that was just amazing from the region. But then moving into recorded history, I guess the region's, you know, first recorded and documented when Cyrus the Great moved into it, you know, in the mid 6th century BC. And then, you know, following Cyrus's conquests, you know, the region was essentially under Persian control for the next couple centuries. And then you get the arrival of a certain bright young lad named Alexander the Great. And so maybe you can help us take up the story from there a little bit.
Yes, well, as you say, it was good, like, with the background and stuff like that, you know, the Persian Empire, Bactria has become, over the 200 years of Achaemenid rule, and it's become one of the most important regions in the whole of the Persian Empire. And one of the key reasons for this is a military reason. You mentioned the Oxus culture, you know, because all the cities, like the main flourishing cities of Bactria, were spaced all along, like the banks of the Oxus or its tributaries, you know, the most famous being the city of Bactra itself. And so they're really good, fertile lands from where they were able to rear these really powerful horses. And these horses, Bactria, the natives of Bactria soon became renowned as like these famous, formidable cavalrymen. And, you know, from the plains of Plataea in Greece, all the way, of course, to the plain of Gaugamela in 331 BC with Alexander the Great. Between that time and in those battles especially, the Bactrian cavalry are viewed as like the Persian elite horsemen.
Right.
And it's a reputation well deserved, as we'll see. But going back, I'm not going to do too much on that. As you said, so Alexander the Great, he's defeated the Persian king Darius III, you know, in the two critical battles, the Battle of Issus and the Battle of Gaugamela. He's conquered the four main administrative capitals of the Achaemenid Empire, Ecbatana, Babylon, Susa, and famously he's destroyed the royal capital at Persepolis, the royal Achaemenid capital. And in, I think it's mid-330 BC, Darius is killed whilst he's attempting to flee eastwards. He is intending to reach Bactria, where he can raise a new army to still oppose Alexander. But he is killed by one of his subordinates, a man called Bessus. And once again, there's another link to Bactria here, because Bessus was formerly the satrap or governor of Bactria. Now, following this, Bessus, with a small entourage, he retreats. He basically follows what Darius was going to do. He retreats to Bactria, where he hopes to conjure up a new army with which to oppose Alexander the Great. Now, Alexander the Great, he goes in pursuit, and he kind of takes a kind of like a path, logistical reasons. He basically does like a horseshoe path, as it were. He misses out Margiana and doesn't cross the huge desert there. He goes southwards towards Kandahar and Herat, where he founds a couple of cities. Then he goes through the Hindu Kush, and eventually he arrives in the region of Bactria in the spring of 329 BC. Now, in that time, Bessus has said he's been in Bactria, and he's hoping to gain this, to amass this large army with which to oppose Alexander's arrival. And to be honest, he had good reason for thinking this. In the past, the Bactrians had very much been open to supporting challenges to like the Achaemenid throne. They'd done it with Darius I, for instance. But when Alexander gets there, rather than being confronted by like a hostile Bactria, city after city welcome him with open arms, and he faces basically no opposition whatsoever. Bessus is forced to flee. He has to flee north of the Oxus River into the neighboring region of Sogdia, where he similarly is unable to find any support, and he's eventually handed over by his former allies and has a gruesome execution at Alexander's hand.
At least to Alexander's mind, the resistance of Bessus, you know, has been eliminated, so therefore he probably has a feeling that, you know, with that end, you know, the region's going to be coming under his control. But then what happens kind of after that?
Well, 100%. You know, he hasn't had much resistance whatsoever. In fact, when he actually goes into Sogdia in pursuit of Bessus, just before he captures him, he leaves basically a token garrison, like a really small garrison in Bactria. That's how confident he is in believing that Bactria has been completely subdued. And he goes north into Sogdia. He gets control of Bessus. And similarly, in Sogdia, he thinks that the Sogdians kind of welcome him. They don't oppose him, as it were, at least for the start. What Alexander does is he heads north to the northern, I guess, quite a permeable, it's quite a fluid border, but like a physical border, as it were, like in the Yaxartes River, the Syr-Darya River today.
Right.
And there, you mentioned Cyrus the Great's conquest earlier. That was where Cyrus had drawn basically the limit of his Achaemenid Empire. That was where he famously founded his city of Cyropolis. And Alexander does a similar thing. He founds Alexandria Escate, or Alexandria the Furthest. And I think you went there, didn't you, Scott?
Recently I was lucky enough to travel through a portion of Uzbekistan, and when I was in Tashkent in Uzbekistan, I was within tens of miles of the location of Alexander the Farthest, so I was very, very excited about that. Nice. Didn't get a chance to actually visit the ruins, but it would have been fantastic. But yeah, very lucky.
Well, I think they're still debating exactly where it is, but if you could find the ruins, that'd be fantastic.
Sure.
But basically, Alexander, he founds Alexandria Escate. He's very much a key modern source, which I'm looking at for this, is Frank Holtz, who we mentioned earlier. And basically, the ancient sources say the reason why soon the Sogdian nobles and like the region of Sogdia becomes hostile to him is because Alexander, he invites all the Sogdian nobles and some of the Bactrian nobles to a meeting at Bactra, and they fear that that is where they're going to get arrested and they're going to basically lose their status. However, it's actually more likely that it was Alexander's founding of Alexandria Escate which caused this change in opinion in Sogdia. And the reason for this is as follows. Now, when Alexander founds Alexandria the Furthest, he is thinking very much in the European frame of mind. He's seen the north of Macedonia and his father, King Philip II's creation of a frontier in Thrace with his creation of cities such as Philippopolis and Kabylae. And Alexander has this idea of creating this physical border, you know, to emphasize, you know, the borders of his empire. And that's what he does with founding Alexandria Escate. He wants to mark the Yaxartes River as his frontier. Now, I say in European terms, it's nothing new. But for the Sogdians, this was something completely against what they believed, as it were, or what they were used to, because north of the Yaxartes River, you have the nomadic tribes, the Eastern Scythians, or the Eastern Scythians, or the Sakai. Although they shared a lot of culture with the Sogdians further south, and they were very much intermingled with each other quite a lot. So the Yaxartes River wasn't really seen as a border between the two regions. It was like seen as very fluid, as very permeable. But Alexander, by creating Alexandria the Furthest, this military colony with a prime purpose of, you know, erecting this physical border to basically block out the nomads to the north, this angers the Sogdians for that very reason. And because of that, they do not want this city there. Now they see that as Alexander, you know, basically putting his imprint on their society. They don't like that. So, very quickly, the Sogdian nobles that were formerly allied to Alexander across the region, they rebel against him. They manage to levy small bands of Sogdian guerrilla fighters. And over the next 2 years, Alexander faces this really hard-pressed revolt, mainly from the Sogdians. It must be noted that actually very few Bactrians actually take part in the revolt. It is mainly a Sogdian revolt.
Nobles who's revolting is Oxiartes, who served Bessus, and he was the former satrap of Bactria and Sogdia. And then also, this is where you get the entry onto the scene of the Sogdian warlord Spitamenes, the father of Apama, who ends up being Seleucus the First's wife.
Mm, yeah, and Spitamenes, yeah, he's one of the most remarkable generals of the period. I mean, it's no easy fact to say that the 2 years Alexander faces really opposing Spitamenes are probably the hardest of his career. And it is against Spitamenes that Alexander suffers his worst defeat or his worst military setback. And this happens in 329 BC. Alexander, he's still at the Euxates River. He's still trying to finish off building Alexandria the farthest. And he receives word further south from the Sogdian capital, where he has a Macedonian garrison. It's called Marakanda, today's Samarkand. Well, we believe it is. He receives word that the Sogdian warlord Spitamenes, he's gathered about, I think it's about 1,000 or 1,500 Sogdian cavalrymen, this strong cavalry entourage, and he's laid siege to Marakanda, which only has a small garrison. So Alexander, he dispatches a few of his generals and his Sogdian translator as head commander, with mainly with a force consisting largely of Greek Hellenic mercenaries, mainly hoplites, you know, wielding aspis shield and spear and heavy infantry. Some cavalry and some light infantry would have accompanied him as well. But with this force, the man in charge was a guy called Pharnouches, said. And Pharnouches, he leads this force south. He scares away Spitamenes from the walls of Marakanda. The siege is lifted. But immediately, Pharnouches, he goes in pursuit of Spitamenes. And this was the huge mistake, because Spitamenes, he knows the landscape. He knows he's in his home region, as it were. And for the Greek mercenaries especially, and for the Macedonians, this is still a completely alien landscape. I mean, you're far away from any access to the sea. The climate was notably different. You've got deserts. Spitamenes retreats probably past the river into the deserts. And it's and for them, it's this highly alien landscape. And what Spitamenes does, he's reinforced by nomadic allies, and they lure Pharnouches and the Macedonians and the Hellenic troops and their allies. He leads them into a trap where Spitamenes and his cavalry, they attack them from all sides, and what follows basically is a slaughter. Mm-hmm. As I said, it's the worst setback of Alexander the Great's career, and everyone seems to forget this battle, but it's one of the most significant, in my opinion. Yeah, it's a terrible setback for Alexander, and this leads into the next point, which is the fact that what it also does is that it raises the anger among the hoplite mercenaries in Alexander the Great's army. And the reason for that is because just before the Polytimetus River disaster, Alexander has received from Antipater in the west 8,000 new Hellenic mercenaries, like with spear and shield, these heavy infantrymen.
Right.
But their loyalty is dubious, because almost all of them had previously been fighting against the Macedonians, against Antipater, for the Spartan king Agis III during the anti-Macedonian revolt, I think at 331 BC. Now, when Antipater defeats Agis, he has all these mercenaries formerly in Spartan service, basically at his mercy, as it were. And he doesn't kill them. He doesn't kill them because he can't keep them in Greece, because he knows that they are it's a small professional army, as it were. And he can't keep them in Greece because if someone else comes along, Athens, there's already anti-Macedonian sentiment really high there, with people like Lycurgus, Hyperides, Demosthenes. So he can't keep them in Europe. And what he decides then is he has to send reinforcements anyway, and he sends them east to join Alexander in the Far East. He gets rid of them, as it were.
Exactly.
And Alexander, he receives these 8,000 new mercenaries. I said their loyalty is dubious, but now they're in Bactria with him. And it's likely some of these mercenaries were the mercenaries that went and were massacred at the Polytimetus River. Now, you can imagine these mercenaries, they're already not too fond of the Macedonians. They've basically been forced into the middle of the far edges of the known world, probably having no choice whatsoever. And now they've just heard that 2,000 of their comrades, because of inadequate leadership by Alexander's companions, some of his subordinates, have just been massacred. So you can imagine that there's this huge amount of dissent boiling in Alexander's ranks, which is just getting higher and higher. And when Alexander, after a couple of years in Sogdia, Spitamenes, he's a complete nightmare for Alexander. He's probably one of Alexander's greatest foes. He arguably is Alexander's greatest foe, and I say that with difficulty, because I always used to think Memnon of Rhodes was probably more significant, but I think Spitamenes does top that. Spitamenes, he even attacks the citadel of Bactria in the heart of Bactria, and he basically, I believe he sacks the city, or he lures the garrison out and he annihilates them as well. So he inflicts more than one bad defeat on Alexander. When he's finally captured and handed over, I believe he's handed over and then killed, it signals near the end of the revolt. And you then mention that Oxiates, the other Sogdian noble, Alexander, right, has to siege all these rock fortresses, which cost him a lot of men. You know, these are almost impregnable rock fortresses, and logistically they're far away from the rivers. They're built to hold out, and Alexander, he's got the it's impressive that he's able to capture these rock fortresses, but it also takes a lot of manpower from his army. But eventually he realizes that to quell the revolt, he marries the daughter of Oxiates, Roxana, the famed, right, Roxana. And it's quite funny that Arrian and Curtis and all of them say, oh, he did this primarily for love, or that there's this idea that he did it for love. But you can really see, and if you also look at the marriages that his father did as well, Philip, you know, the diplomatic reasons for it are very clear. I mean,
it seems pretty, yeah, straightforward considering the experience he just had, you know, trying to subdue them. So it very much makes sense. One of the other things that was interesting to me when I was looking at this a bit is I don't think people realize how much time Alexander spent in Central Asia. It was essentially the better part of 3 years that he spent here. And the vast majority of that, you know, as you say, was trying to put down this very, very challenging, you know, revolt, which again, I think, like you say, he ended up not so much, you know, being able to do it through arms as through a, you know, political arrangement. So
you're completely right. And you know, when you think of it, you know, Alexander the Great, according to the sources, you know, within, you know, 5 years, he's conquered, you know, he's defeated Darius at Gaugamela. 5 years since crossing into Asia, he basically owns the whole of, like, all the way stretched to Mesopotamia and Media. Yeah, within 5 years, he's at Bactria. He's at the doorstep of Bactria. And as you say, for the next 3 years, he's stuck in this region because he's had to face these rebels, and they don't give up.
Not too long after this, I believe that Alexander starts pushing into India. During Alexander's reign, are there any other, you know, large-scale revolts in either Bactria or Sogdia, or does the political, you know, peace kind of hold for a bit?
Well, no. First of all, must be noted, you know, when Alexander, he does cross the Hindu Kush and they do leave Bactria, the Macedonians and all his army, you can imagine the sigh of relief that must have gone over all of his troops, especially his European troops, you know, just leaving this godforsaken land. And this is important, you know, especially his Macedonians, how, you know, the sense of relief that they were finally, you know, leaving this land, which has caused them so much trouble, right, so much death for comrades who serve them. Of course, you've also had the death of Clytus the Black,
right,
Alexander's cause, you know, during at the height of that. I think you've had the Pages conspiracy, you've Callisthenes' death as well.
Not great for morale, definitely.
No, exactly. And so you can, the thing is that Alexander, he can't leave there without leaving a garrison there. And if we quickly go back to this, and I'll talk about the revolt, because it's important to understand the revolt in his lifetime. Those dissident Greek mercenaries, Alexander knows that they're angry, and the Polytimetus River disaster probably, I said it, just heightens these tensions. And Alexander knows he's got to leave a garrison in Bactria, Sogdia, mainly on the frontier posts, you know, basically to fight off small marauding bands of Sogdians, which weren't, so the region still yet wasn't fully pacified. And one of the ideas, he does not want to take these dissident Greek mercenaries, the Hellenic mercenaries, into India. They're too much of a burden, and he can't trust them. I think the key reason there, in my personal opinion, from my research, is that he doesn't trust them. And so he leaves a huge garrison in Bactria and Sogdia, mainly in Sogdia, but also in Bactria, of 20, I think, I believe it's about, I think it's like 13,000, 15,000 men. A large proportion of them, almost all of them, are either the Hellenic mercenaries, the hoplites and the distant ones, and some Macedonians, like mainly those who were either too old or injured for service, you know, they had to accept. They're not happy about being left in this alien landscape. They really don't want to be left there. But for Alexander, it's a great solution for getting rid of these, you know, these troubling soldiers. So Alexander leaves Bactria. I think he leaves in, it's either 327 or 326 BC. And he goes into the Indus Valley and he does all his, you know, his invasions and his battles at the Hydaspes and all that, all that down. When Alexander the Great's army is in India, for the Greek mercenaries in Bactria, first they put up with it for a bit because they know Alexander's alive, and they probably do fear. They fear doing anything unless Alexander comes back with a heavy fist, and you know he crushes them, and he's shown in the past that he can be merciless at times to cement his authority. But then a rumor reaches Bactrian Sogdia, and the Greek mercenaries, especially in Bactrian Sogdia, that Alexander has died whilst campaigning in India. And this is after he assaults the stronghold of the Mali tribe, where he gets an arrow in his lung, I believe it is. And so this rumor reaches Bactrian Sogdia, and the Greek mercenaries, they see it as the time to revolt. And so this is the time, you know, to gather together and to start their anabasis, as it were, their journey home through the whole of Asia, back to the Greek heartlands. You must remember, like, although that seems like such an audacious logistical task, these soldiers, I mean, they were desperate to get home. They wanted to get home, and so they were desperate to leave Bactria. And what happens is this party forms, this political party forms in the center of Bactria, and a Greek mercenary general called Athenodorus. He, with a small band, he captures Bactria. He kills the Macedonian satrap. He's getting ready to march home with it, and he's got a large thousands of Greek mercenaries, I think, are going to support him there. And then concrete news reaches Bactria that Alexander is actually very much alive.
It's always funny when that news catches you at a particularly critical moment like that, when you've already kind of committed to a course of action.
Exactly right. You've committed to a course of action. Athenodorus has crossed his Rubicon at this time. There's no going back. So he's still, but quite a few Greek mercenaries, they leave his cause, it seems likely they did. And he gathers a small band of people, and he prepares basically to lead them home. But just before he gets off, things get even worse, because Athenodorus gets assassinated. Basically, there's a bit of stasis in Bactria for a bit. It's like the Greek commanders are kind of confused whether shall we kill the guy who, you know, who's now usurped, this guy called Byton, or shall we not, and stuff like that. And then it goes on and on, but eventually, a bit of luck in it as well, Byton, the man who has orchestrated the killing of Athenodorus, he is rescued, as it were, from execution, and he, with I think about 3,000 other Greek mercenaries, start marching home to Greece.
Wow.
Starts.
So they've got their dog-eared copy of Xenophon's Anabasis, you know, for a guidebook, and they're gonna do it. Okay.
Well, it's remarkable. It's remarkable. They, like, I mean, according to Curtius, they do make it home, or it suggests that they do make it home. But that's the revolt that you have in Bactria during Alexander the Great's lifetime. You still got many Greek mercenaries still in Bactria whilst Alexander's alive, but from 325 BC, you know, barely 2 years after Alexander's left Bactria, you've already got, you know, this first revolt, as it were.
Returning from India, you know, after this whole affair, you know, kind of subsides, he doesn't end up spending much more time in Bactria or in Central Asia. I think essentially from that point forward, the thoughts start turning toward, you know, home and or at least, you know, Babylon, in my understanding. Does that sound about right?
No, he never goes back to Bactria. And to be honest, I don't think the Macedonian soldiers would have let him. And as you say, he starts thinking very much on the West, on Babylon, on the center of his empire, and future campaigns, not in the East, but in the West. It's a key thing with his successors as well. Apart from Seleucus, where do they always dream to have their empires? You know, by the Mediterranean, not in the Far East. back, this huge change when Alexander dies in 323 BC is one of the greatest political shake-ups the world has ever seen. If you think Brexit's bad now, I mean, you should have seen this back then. It's no clear air, as it were. Within 48 hours of Alexander's death, 48 hours, the room in which Alexander the Great died in, Macedonian blood is spilled on the walls of the room because there's a fight between some of the generals led by a guy called Perdiccas and the infantry led by an infantry general called Meleager, and they come to blows in the actual room that Alexander expired within 48 hours of his death. It's remarkable.
That's amazing.
That status. And that whole week in Babylon, where there is this crisis between the infantry led by Meleager and their choice of king, and the generals who want someone else, or they want a regency, or they all have different aims, basically. They can't agree on anything. It's a remarkable week in Hellenistic history, which definitely deserves more attention. But after the dust has settled and all that, is the main man who comes out on top is a guy called Perdiccas. Now, Perdiccas, he's the highest ranking general in Alexander the Great's army when he dies. And though he is contested by famous other successors such as Ptolemy, mainly Ptolemy, but also Leonatus, Perdiccas does become regent for Alexander's simple-minded half-brother, Philip Arrhidaeus III, and now Alexander the Great's infant son, Alexander IV. The first big test he faces after all these generals have left Babylon to go to their own new governorships is from Bactria, from nowhere else but Bactria. Because, yeah, and you know how like the last Bactrian revolt erupted when they heard news of Alexander's death, but they were stopped because when they heard more concrete news, that's why a lot of Greek Bactrians out there, Greeks stayed out there. Imagine the reaction when they actually hear concrete confirmation that Alexander the Great is really dead this time. The garrisons in Bactria and Sogdia, great upheaval. Basically, the frontier posts are completely emptied, and over a period of months, because it was quite this logistically, this was a remarkable achievement. But then the Greek mercenaries managed to assemble an army of 23,000 men, filtered out from all the places in Bactria, Sogdia, probably some in nearby Margiana, Arachosia, and they're all mustered together under the leadership of a mercenary general called Philon. They all start mustering together for a great march home. Now, of course, that would take a couple of months to complete, logistically wise, you know, getting all the supplies and getting all the people together. And it's in that time that Perdiccas in Babylon, he hears of this revolt in Bactria. Now, at the same time, you've got revolts springing up in other parts of the empire. I mean, in Cappadocia, in Asia Minor, you've got this powerful Persian warlord called Ariarates, basically running riots and having complete control with an army of 40,000 odd or so. In Europe, you've got the Athenians and a powerful mercenary army under the command of Leosthenes, besieging the Macedonian viceroy Antipater in southern Thessaly. And so you have these outbreaks in Europe, in Central Asia, and now in Bactria. But for Perdiccas, it's the revolt in Bactria which is the most serious, the most grave for him. And the reason for it is quite simple. It's because in the West, with the Athenians and their allies, there are a plethora of well-known, famous, formidable generals, each with their own small army nearby, who can go to help out. And that's eventually what they do. You have Ficus first, where you have Leonatus, and then you have the more formidable Craterus. They both go over to help Antipater. So you have this plethora of remarkable generals in the West with their own powerful armies. But in the East, it's a completely different matter. There is no large, substantial, significant army that I can see between Perdiccas and the royal army in Babylon and Bactria. 23,000 men, they're going through your lands. They're gonna basically pillage the whole area. The majority of these would have been mercenaries. They would have been veterans of the frontiers. These would have been formidable fighters. And that's what makes Perdiccas, in my opinion, I think he gets so scared, is that he realizes that this huge army, this formidable army, is coming his way. And he needs to stop them before they start laying waste the empire in the East. he needs the nucleus of his force to be soldiers that he knows are formidable soldiers too. So he needs them to be the Macedonians that he's got in his royal army. Now, he's only got a limited number. He's got about 10,000. And remember what we were saying earlier, the Macedonians hated their time in Bactria. They hated Far East. In the end, Perdiccas is forced to select them by lot. He has to choose them by lot. You know, the unlucky ones have to go. They're forced to go back east. And that's the level of anger that you can feel the Macedonians for going back to this hated land. So they start marching east, but obviously they're going to be reinforced by a large number of troops from the garrisons of the governors in the east. But these troops wouldn't have been able to contest the, they wouldn't have been able to contest the Philon's force without aid from the royal army in Babylon. And in command, Perdiccas places Python. So Python, with 3,000 men, he marches east. He's reinforced by about, I think it's about 16,000, 17,000 troops from the governors in the east. So there would have been some Greek mercenaries still fighting for Perdiccas from these garrisons. There would have been a lot of Asian troops from places like, there have been Persians, there have been Medians, there have been Arachosians, there have been Mardians, like all these remarkable troops. They would all have gone together to fight against Philon. And they line up for battle for, I think it's around the end of 323 BC or the beginning of 322.
Okay.
Python, he goes to Bactria, he faces off against Philon's army on this field, and it looks like, at the start, when the lines do clash, it looks like Philon's going to win. It looks like the Greeks in Bactria are going to win. They outnumber the Macedonian, Python's army, and they also, arguably of higher quality overall, because most of them, or almost all of them, are veteran soldiers. But at the crucial moment, one thing that Python has on his side is that he has the wealth of the Persian Empire behind him, the Achaemenid Empire. And no one is completely impenetrable to bribes. No one is completely immune to bribes. And Python, he gets a spy to infiltrate the enemy army, and he manages to bribe one of the mercenary generals in Philon's army, who commands 3,000 men, a man called Letidorus, to abandon Philon and his men in the heat of battle. He does that. Letidorus and his men, they go to a nearby hill, they watch the battle, and panic spreads among Philon's force. They believe that they're being surrounded, and after that the revolt is basically crushed. They pretend to have a reconciliation ceremony between the defeated Greek mercenaries and the Macedonians. But during the heart, in the middle of the ceremony, the Macedonians, remember, they're angry at being come back to this land. They don't like these mercenaries one bit. They're the reason they've had to come back here. They take out their swords, and a slaughter ensues.
Wow.
The red mist descends. It truly does. And Python was likely in on it. I mean, there was this idea that Python wanted to forge his empire, his great empire in the Far East, with the defeated Greek mercenaries and the Macedonians. But then you think of it, the Macedonians would never have allowed this. That's it. That's basically the Bactrian revolt. Many of the Greek mercenaries, almost all of them, are slaughtered. Those that do remain in Bactria stay there.
Well, thank you so much for your time. I very much appreciate it, and your expertise, that especially in all the great details on the Bactrian adventures of Alexander and the revolts, etc., and then in the aftermath, especially. That was, a lot of that's new information to me. It's very, very interesting, and I definitely look forward to your forthcoming book.
It's an absolute pleasure, and yeah, the book will be out. I think. 2021, sometime around there. But look out for it. Alexander's Successors at War, part one. But you'll see.
Well, thanks again. I very much appreciate it.
No, thank you. I absolutely loved it.